Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 333, titled Forward into the Past, subtitled Connecting the Dots, Part 6. This is being recorded on October 28th of 2001, and is another broadcast dealing with the terrible subject of the terrorist blitzkrieg of 9/11/2001. As I've said in other programs about that subject, I believe that the executive authority in this act was what I call the Underground Reich, embracing powerful elements in our country and in the Middle East. And by way of illustrating what I believe was involved at the operational arm, or as the operational arm of this attack by the Underground Reich on the United States, we're going to take a look at some past intelligence relationships between elements of U.S. intelligence and terrorist elements connected to not only the Underground Reich, but the Third Reich in its overground phase. And this is by way of illustrating the type of relationship that I believe doubled on the United States in 9/11/2001. And, of course, as I've indicated in the past, there are strong connections between these types of elements and the Bush administrations and powerful elements in this country. The following is from the San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday, September 18th of 2001. This is an article by David Ignatius of the Washington Post, formerly of the Wall Street Journal, and this is a discussion of our need to recruit terrorists as informants for the intelligence community, and in fact, this is the type of relationship that I believe was exploited by the Underground Reich to double on the United States. The San Jose Mercury News titled this, Good Spies Need Help from the Bad Guys. And this deals with Ali Hassan Salameh, the alleged mastermind of the Olympics massacre of 1972, who, as we looked at in RFA 22, was an informant for the CIA. Ignatius writes, What the CIA did back then was to open a secret channel with the PLO's chief of intelligence, a charismatic operative named Ali Hassan Salameh. At that time, Palestinian terrorism against the United States was a serious threat, as vitriolic, if not as deadly, as Osama bin Laden is today. When these secret contacts began in 1970, they had the explicit approval of Yasser Arafat himself. But the relationship evolved and expanded over the years, and Salameh came to be regarded within the CIA as a witting asset, uncontrolled and unpaid, but immensely valuable. Skipping down. Make no mistake, Salameh, the CIA's contact, was a terrorist himself. He had been a key operative in Arafat's covert Black September organization, and the Israelis believe he helped plan the massacre of Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics in 1972. They even targeted Salameh for assassination. To gather information about terrorism, in other words, the CIA was prepared to sup with the devil. Even after Munich, the CIA worked to maintain its intelligence link to Salameh. Well, what we're going to do now is to go forward into the past. We're going to listen to an excerpt from RFA 22, recorded on July 8th of 1986. And in turn, we're going to hear a reference to an article by this very same David Ignatius from the Wall Street Journal of February 10th of 1983. Now, note the heritage here. Salameh, who worked as a CIA asset, was the mastermind of the Olympics massacre of 1972. He, in turn, was the son of Hassan Salameh, a key operative on behalf of Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, a major in the SS, and a key player in the Underground Reich. And we're going to hear that relationship discussed in the excerpt you're about to hear. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. This, again, from RFA 22, July 8, 1986. And, in fact, it was even more than just a friendship. Hassan Salameh was one of the most loyal lieutenants of Haj Amin al-Husseini, both while he was working for the Third Reich, and, again, as Nip indicated, Haj Amin al-Husseini was working with the so-called outside Turks that we reviewed in Radio Free America number 14 about the World Anti-Communist League. We also went into it at considerable length in Radio Free America number 21, the last of our shows about the Pope shooting, if people would like to read up more about that. Hassan Salameh, again, is one of the close assistants, one of the key, not only a good friend, but one of the key aides of Haj Amin al-Husseini during World War II. We'll take a look at their post-war association in a couple of minutes. But again, Haj Amin al-Husseini is the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the spiritual leader of all Palestinian Muslims. He also was a major in the SS and a key Third Reich functionary. We're going to read now a short section about a Well, a proposed Third Reich military mission, which we're going to see several of the names that we've encountered so far cropping up in the same context. Reading now from a book called The Quest for the Red Prince. It was co-authored by two Israeli authors, both of whom with Mossad connections, Michael Bar-Zohar, Bar-Zohar, and Eitan Haber, Haber, published in hardcover by William Morrow & Company, copyright 1983. Now, the operation that's being described here is a proposed diversionary operation from the Battle of the Bulge, basically. Now, the Battle of the Bulge was the last offensive ever undertaken. That's actually the American name for the Ardennes Offensive, the last offensive operation ever undertaken by the Third Reich. This was an attempt, basically, to force the Western Allies to conclude a separate military peace with Germany, after which it was proposed that they would join together and attack the Soviet Union. At any rate, because at this point, this was very late in the war, the Ardennes Offensive actually began in December of 1944. Because of the highly unfavorable numerical situation which the Nazis faced, they were badly outnumbered, it was proposed that a number of diversionary operations be staged to draw off Allied forces from the proposed offensive. One of these diversionary operations was to be basically a Palestinian uprising, an anti-British, recall that Palestine at this time was a British colony, an anti-British Palestinian uprising featuring largely the pro-Nazi Arabs under the command of Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and SS Major who we just looked at a second ago. Now, this operation was to be kicked off by the poisoning of the wells of Tel Aviv, the largest Jewish settlement in Palestine at that time. It was proposed that with the poisoning of the wells of Tel Aviv and the subsequent destruction of tens of thousands of Jews, the Palestinians, given a little bit of encouragement, would openly rise up against the British. This would force the British to transfer large numbers of troops away from the proposed offensive in the Ardennes and down to the Middle East, thereby obviously making the numerical odds considerably more favorable for the Third Reich. Now, this again is a diversionary operation planned for the Battle of the Bulge to siphon off British strength. Interestingly enough, the man that Haj Amin al-Husseini chose to lead the mission, it was unsuccessful, was Hassan Salame. It's also worth noting that, again, Otto Skorzeny, whose name was going to be mentioned here in connection with another better-known diversionary operation in the Battle of the Bulge, something called Operation Gripe. We're going to talk about that in a second. Otto Skorzeny was in charge of all commando training for the Third Reich, so nominally at least, Hassan Salame, in this particular mission, would have fallen under Skorzeny's jurisdiction. It's unclear whether there was any contact whatsoever between them. There may not have been any, but since Skorzeny was in command of all irregular forces on land, nominally at least, Hassan Salame, in this commando capacity, was a Skorzeny subordinate. Should also be noted that Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was the, as our author Little John put it, was ministering to the spiritual needs of Soviet Muslims. I suspect that some of that may have been tongue-in-cheek, but it's worth noting that in that capacity, Haj Amin al-Husseini has to invariably have worked with Reinhard Gehlen, the intelligence chief on the Eastern Front, particularly with regard to recruiting Muslims for SS units. So there must have been considerable wartime contact between Haj Amin al-Husseini and Gehlen, and nominally at least, although there may very well have been no personal contact between them, Hassan Salame, Haj Amin al-Husseini's lieutenant in the proposed Palestinian uprising as a diversion from the Ardennes, he has to have fallen under the jurisdiction, at least, of Otto Skorzeny. Again, reading from the book, The Quest for the Red Prince, and about the proposed diversion from the Battle of the Bulge, the authors write as follows. In the autumn of 1944, Germany's military situation seemed desperate. After the liberation of Paris, Eisenhower's armies had reached the German border west of the Rhine. On the 24th of October, the city of Aachen fell, becoming the first German city to be captured by the Allies. The Russian armies, meanwhile, had reached the Vistula and the plains of East Prussia and were preparing their huge January offensive. Facing the danger of imminent defeat, Hitler desperately sought a way of delaying the onslaught on German national territory. Since the threat from the west seemed nearer, he decided to concentrate his efforts on the Belgian front. In the greatest secrecy, the Führer assembled all the reserves he could raise in Germany for a last-chance gamble, the launching of a surprise attack that would split the U.S. 3rd and 1st Armies and capture the port of Antwerp, thus severing Eisenhower's lifeline. The offensive also included a swift flank attack intended to destroy the British and Canadian armies stretched along the Belgian-Dutch border. If the offensive succeeded and the Western Front was secured, Hitler could turn east to halt the Red Army. To confuse and disrupt the Allied response, Hitler had to use all the aces up his sleeve. One of the stratagems he conceived was to be what later became famous as Operation Gripe. 2,000 English-speaking soldiers under the command of the legendary Otto Skorzeny were to dress in American uniforms and infiltrate behind Allied lines. Riding on American tanks and jeeps, they were to sow confusion, ambush dispatch riders, cut telephone wires, misdirect traffic, and blow up ammunition and fuel dumps. Simultaneously, the German High Command decided to foment internal trouble in the most vulnerable areas of the British Empire, hence diverting army vigilance and tying down important military forces far away from the European theater. The choice immediately fell on Palestine. In his frequent contacts with the authorities of the Reich, the Mufti had succeeded in convincing his interlocutors that the Palestinian Arabs were deeply frustrated and willing to rebel against the British. All the other neighboring Arab countries were more or less independent, the Mufti pointed out, and their governments were pro-British. The Palestinian Arabs, the only Arab nation to which self-rule and independence were denied, were ready to fight for their freedom. But there was another reason, besides the Mufti's eloquence, which influenced the German High Command's choice of Palestine for their operation. On the 19th of September, 1944, following a long and tedious correspondence between Winston Churchill and Chaim Weizmann, the British government decided to establish a Jewish brigade as part of the British Army. The brigade recruits would be mostly Palestinian Jews. The news threw the Mufti into a terrible rage. Here he was in Germany, having been trying for years to form the nucleus of an Arab liberation army, and finally the British were stealing his idea and creating a Jewish brigade. He besieged the German leaders, especially von Ribbentrop and Himmler, demanding an immediate German declaration about the creation of an Arab army. The government of the Reich decided to placate the Mufti and make the announcement of the creation of an Arab brigade on the 2nd of November, the anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. Himmler and von Ribbentrop sent the Mufti letters to that effect, and the High Command was instructed to follow up the declaration with a military operation which would prove that the Arab army was already in action.
Continuing with the quest for the Red Prince, the Mufti's long-forgotten project to instigate an Arab uprising in Palestine was hurriedly recovered from the archives, and an operational plan was swiftly concocted. According to the first blueprint, the Luftwaffe was to parachute into the Jordan Valley a group of German agents, most of them born in the tiny German colony in Palestine. They were to be accompanied by several Palestinian chieftains from the close entourage of the Mufti. Once safely landed, they were to set up the first operational bases in Palestine and to make contact with nationalist leaders throughout the country. The Germans would be traveling with false passports established in Jewish names. After the preparatory stage was over and the foundations laid, a second, much larger group of Germans and Arabs would be parachuted into Palestine and would call the population to arms. The revolt would swiftly spread all over the country and overflow to the neighboring Arab nations. A dashing colonel from the notorious Brandenburg Division was dispatched to the Bellevue Palace to brief the Mufti about the plan. Husseini listened to him in silence, an attentive smile painted all over his cherubic face. Finally, he spoke. "I agree with the project," he softly said, "but on one condition." His guest eyed him quizzically. "I want them to poison the wells of Tel Aviv," said the Mufti. While the officer listened to him in astounded silence, the Mufti calmly explained his reasons. That single operation, he pointed out, could guarantee the successful outcome of the revolt. The sudden death of tens of thousands of Jews in Tel Aviv would sow panic all over Palestine. Tel Aviv would be deserted by the surviving population. Thousands would head toward small villages in the countryside, where they would be massacred by the Arab fellaheen. Many others would flee the country by any means possible, throwing Palestine into chaos. On the other hand, the deaths of so many Jews would tremendously impress hundreds of thousands of Palestinian Arabs, who would consequently join the revolt. The German officer stiffly clicked his heels and returned to his superiors. The next morning, he was back at the Bellevue Palace. "I am instructed to inform you," he said to the Mufti, "that the High Command agrees to your project." The Mufti nodded with satisfaction and turned to his aide-de-camp. "Call Hassan Salameh," he ordered. During the following week, Salameh and a few hand-picked Palestinians underwent intensive training at a German commando base. They practiced parachute jumps, the handling of small weapons, and guerrilla tactics. They also underwent a crash course in operating radio transceivers and unconventional communication techniques. They were initiated into the Mufti's secret plan and instructed about the ways to poison the water supply sources of Tel Aviv. Maps and detailed diagrams were drawn up by some of the Palestinian-born Germans who were also to take part in the operation. As the operation's D-Day approached, several trainees were dropped from the first commando. Finally, only two Arabs remained. Hassan Salameh, and another former participant in the 1936 Arab Revolt and a native of Jerusalem, Abdul Latif. At the beginning of November, several heavy crates and bags of equipment were loaded aboard a Heinkel 111, which took off for an air base in northern Italy. Aboard were Latif, Salameh, and three German agents. And during the night of the 5th of November, they set off on the final leg of their journey.
So again, Hassan Salameh is the man chosen by SS Major Hajimin al-Husseini, also the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, to lead this abortive. By the way, the mission failed. A number of things went wrong. They weren't able to either poison the wells of Tel Aviv or to establish that uprising. It's interesting to note that Hajimin al-Husseini chose Hassan Salameh, one of his close friends and a key aide, to undertake this mission. And again, as repeated, nominally at least, Hassan Salameh has to have come under Skorzeny's jurisdiction here, in as much as Skorzeny was in charge of all commando training for the Third Reich. There may very well have been no personal contact between them. In fact, probably wasn't, but it's an interesting thing to take note as we pursue the past and the political development of the events and involved with the 1972 Olympics massacre. Again, Hassan Salameh, the father of Ali Hassan Salameh, who is credited with planning the Olympics massacre, and who also, within a year, was working with the CIA. After World War II, Hajimin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, retrenched and basically carried his struggle against the Jews and the Jews in Palestine through the termination of the Third Reich and on up into Israel's War of Independence, and where essentially his tactics and his philosophy and so forth remained essentially the same. And Hassan Salameh also jumped with Hajimin al-Husseini from the Third Reich to the I don't know what you'd call it, Arab independence movement. Anyway, the movement for an independent Arab Palestine. Reading again now of the retrenchment by Hajimin al-Husseini as well as Hassan Salameh after World War II and their participation in the fighting immediately following the establishing of the State of Israel. Reading again from The Quest for the Red Prince. It was not until April 6, 1945 in Berlin that the Mufti finally surrendered to reality and admitted that his great design had been shattered to pieces. Germany was beaten, and her final capitulation was a question of weeks, maybe days. Berlin was in ruins, and the Nazis were frantically mobilizing children and old men to defend the shambles of the Reich. That morning, the last supporters of the Mufti, a mere dozen men, were asked to meet him in the Bellevue Palace. For the first time, they saw their leader gloomy and depressed. The frail, soft-spoken Arab knew well that his life was in danger. Neither the Russians nor the Allies would forgive him his crimes if they could only lay their hands on him. He was wanted for inflammatory Nazi propaganda, dispatching German agents behind the Allied lines, active assistance to the Germans in North Africa, recruiting thousands of Muslims in Yugoslavia to the SS units, and persistently lobbying in the Chancellery of the Reich for the extermination of the Jews. He was also accused of planning to establish gas chambers and ovens in the Dotan Valley in Palestine after the Nazi victory. Still, the Nazi victory was nothing but a mirage in which even Husseini did not believe anymore. Gone were the glorious days when he had lived in Berlin like a king, attended and pampered by the Germans as one of their most illustrious guests. Gone were the days when the ministers of the Reich would be the guests of the Mufti at his opulent dinners, where they would gorge on caviar and salmon, rare goose liver, mangoes, and sweet damascene baklava. Today he was alone in his big residence with his last status symbol, a black Mercedes driven by an SS guard. As his close friends gathered in his spacious dining room, the driver walked in carrying Red Cross packages. Each one of the Arabs present was given a package containing tinned food that had been originally packed for prisoners of war. The Mufti then took a thick wad of banknotes from his purse, Swiss francs, U.S. dollars, British gold certificates, and distributed it among his followers. "It's all over for us here," he said calmly. "Each of you must find his own way to get back home. There we shall resume our struggle in different conditions." He rose from his place, bade farewell to his friends, and walked out to his car. Two of his closest assistants were the only ones allowed to escort him. The same day he left Berlin and was driven to Austria. There he boarded a light plane belonging to the Luftwaffe, which flew him into Switzerland. The local authorities, though, refused to grant him political asylum, and he had to proceed to France, where he surrendered to the French gendarmes. The French immediately threw the Mufti and his two henchmen into the Paris prison of Cherche Midi. But not for long. It took them only a few days to realize the political asset which this world-renowned Muslim leader could represent for France. He could render important services to the country and help France assert her position in her North African protectorates. On the explicit orders of General de Gaulle, Hajimin al-Husseini was released from the Cherche Midi jail and confined to a pleasant villa on the outskirts of Paris. The protection of the Mufti was assured by a discreet detail of Secret Service agents.
Continuing with the quest for the Red Prince, even the Nuremberg trials, which started soon after the war, did not change the status of the Mufti. By rights, he should have been in Nuremberg, sharing the box of the accused with his friends of yesterday.
Ted, let me interrupt 1 minute. I forgot. Broadcasting Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. Let's take care of that one. We still have a chance.
Glad you did that. By rights, he should have been in Nuremberg, sharing the box of the accused with his friends of yesterday. Ribbentrop, Himmler, Goering. Yugoslavia also demanded his extradition for war crimes. But the French wanted to keep him for themselves. The British feared that an extradition demand on their part would trigger a new eruption of anti-British feeling in the Arab countries. The Americans were not interested in the Mufti, even though Jewish leaders in the United States forcefully demanded that Husseini be put on trial for his war crimes. Finally, the Mufti felt that it was time for him to return home. The American Jews were becoming dangerous. During the visit of the new French Prime Minister, Léon Blum, to the U.S., they succeeded in obtaining his promise that the Mufti would be extradited to the occupation forces in Germany. His arrest was delayed, though, by a quick action by Georges Bidault, the right-wing minister of foreign affairs. But the Mufti was told that French soil was becoming too dangerous for him. Husseini had grown used to quick escapes and masquerades. His reddish beard, shaven once again, a false Syrian passport, and a genuine American military travel pass in his pocket, he boarded a TWA airplane in Paris on May 29, 1946. The same day, he landed in Cairo and was lavishly feted by Farouk, the young king of Egypt. A few days later, Husseini appeared in Lebanon. Palestine was banned for him by the British, and he realized that he could return there only at the head of an army. Now that the World War was over, the battle for Palestine was entering its decisive stage. In his absence, the Supreme Arab Committee had been revived, and the chairman's seat had been reserved for him. He established his headquarters in the pleasant mountain resort of Alai, and sent a coded telegram to his faithful followers in Jerusalem. "Papa has returned," the cable said. The time had come for him to, quote, resume his struggle, as he had promised his followers in Berlin on that gloomy April morning. One of the first men he summoned to his villa in Alai was Sheikh Hassan Salameh. They did not talk about the past. They did not discuss the failure of the Arab Brigade, nor the collapse of the project to poison the wells of Tel Aviv and raise the Palestinians in arms. The Mufti sketched in rough outline the main points of his plan. He would create a Palestinian army which would exterminate the Jews. The projected Jewish state would be defeated, and Palestine would become an Arab state under his own leadership. He promptly appointed Salameh as commander-in-chief of the entire central region of Palestine, including the coastal plain, Jaffa, Ramleh, and Lod. He would be second to only one man, Abd el-Qadir el-Husseini, the Mufti's young nephew who had just returned from a long exile in Saudi Arabia. Abd el-Qadir was to be appointed supreme commander of the Arab forces in Palestine as well as commander of the Jerusalem district, where he had fought during the Arab revolt. As for Salameh, he was instructed to return to Palestine immediately and raise an Arab fighting force to prepare for the forthcoming struggle for the possession of the land. Salameh, whose devotion to the Mufti was absolute, did not waste time. Soon he was back in Palestine, surreptitiously moving from one village to another, visiting his former companions from the days of the revolt, enrolling them again in his private army. This time he met no organized opposition to his authority. Many of the chieftains he had known were either dead or too old. Some, like Abd el-Razek, had been granted a government pardon and had left the field clear for a younger, ambitious leader like himself. The anti-Mufti forces, on the other hand, their chiefs wiped out by the bloody massacres of Salameh and his followers, were unable to offer an alternative leadership to the Arabs of Palestine. Salameh quickly succeeded in organizing a nucleus of 400 fighters in his district alone. They were equipped with light arms, partly taken from the caches where they had been concealed in 1939, partly stolen or even bought from British soldiers in Palestine. Salameh was confident that his 400-man army would swell to thousands as soon as the fighting started. The traditional method of the faza, the alert, enabled him to enroll masses of fellaheen and city youth for any particular operation. After the battle was over, most had returned to their workshops and villages until the next call to arms. During 1947, Salameh prepared for the war against the Jews. In absolute secrecy, he traveled several times to Beirut to purchase additional arms and contact exiled Palestinians. He even had several German officers smuggled across the border and into his district, to serve as instructors to his men.
Interrupting, this is before the Skorzenia mission, so don't confuse the German officers being used here on an ad hoc basis with the CIA contingent under Galen that we looked at earlier.
And when the UN Assembly voted for the creation of a Jewish state, Salome was ready and waiting. On the very next day, by ambushing Heller's bus, he fired the first shot in the Battle of Palestine. And thus, dramatically surprising both Arabs and Jews, he came out into the open.
So basically, we have the two key figures that we looked at with regard to the potential uprising in Palestine as a diversionary measure away from the Ardennes offensive, Haj Amin al-Husseini, SS major, spiritual leader of Palestinian Muslims, and his top aide, Hassan Salameh, father of Ali Hassan Salameh, who leads the Olympics massacre and who worked for CIA. We find the two people continuing their struggle, as they put it, from the Third Reich on up to the Israeli War of Independence following the establishment of Israel. It should be noted, too, that Ali Hassan Salameh, the son of Hassan Salameh, later, by the way, Hassan Salameh was assassinated by an Israeli commando unit during the Israeli War of Independence. His son, Ali Hassan Salameh, moved in some of the same kinds of circles and has retained some of the same kinds of contacts as his father. Both of the details I'm about to read you certainly may be apocryphal, but they're worth noting in light of the development of Ali Hassan Salameh, one of the key figures in our story this evening. Again, reading from The Quest for the Red Prince. In 1958, the family returned to Beirut, but the eruption of the first Lebanese civil war made them move to Cairo. Ali continued his studies in Egypt, and after graduation left for Germany, where he studied engineering sporadically in several universities, but mostly he enjoyed life. He developed a taste for expensive, fashionable clothes, black becoming his favorite color. His machismo, his dark, handsome looks, and his natural charm made him irresistible to the young German Fraulein, and in no time he had established a reputation as a womanizer and a playboy. Skipping down. In 1963, he returned to Cairo and meekly submitted to his mother's decision. He was to wed a young woman from whom his family had chosen for him. She was a quiet, plain girl from the al-Husseini family, the family of the Mufti, to whom the Salamehs had been devoted all their lives. From his residence in exile in Beirut, the aging Mufti gave his blessing to the wedding. So, Ali Hassan Salameh, the leader of the Olympics massacre, man who works with CIA shortly after leading that foray, the son of Hassan Salameh, Nazi commando, devotee of SS major and Palestinian spiritual leader Haj Amin al-Husseini, marries a woman from al-Husseini's family. Also, interestingly, spent a lot of time in Germany, a place to which he was to return and in which he was to achieve his greatest fame or greatest infamy, depending on how one wants to look at it. That again from RFA 22, July 8th of 1986. And by the way, the details about Ali Hassan Salameh's marital contacts are substantive. We're going to continue with an analysis of this networking involving the Underground Reich inside two of this program. RFA 22 and other programs that I've discussed are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Spitfirelist is one word. You can visit their website, equipped with real audio, at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfirelist is one word. And sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, has been archiving the For the Record programs on real audio. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emory, one word, DAVEEMORY. And the vast bulk of the For the Record series, a few numbers are still missing, but the vast bulk of the For the Record series is available for download only on a longer URL that has links from both the WFMU web URL and from the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. This concludes Side A of For the Record program number 333, Forward into the Past, Connecting the Dots, Part 6, recorded on October 28th of 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.